From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. I understand there's some sort of tournament going on. Two tournaments, you say. Wait, three tournaments. Well, we'd better get to them. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest on the men's and women's NCAA, NIT, and the brand new college basketball invitational tourneys. Also, Caltech men's basketball scores on the big screen, even if it can't on the court. Also ahead, expatriate rugby fans of Six Nations gather to celebrate the Six Nations Cup.
Everybody wants England to lose, yeah. That's nothing against the English. Just want them to lose.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you're a favorites player, I have only this to say, and that's that yesterday perhaps was not your favorite day. For if you are a guy who thinks that form is all that matters, this morning, I am sad to say, your brackets are in tatters. Although number one seed University of North Carolina slipped by 16 seed Mount St. Mary's 113-74, and number two seed Tennessee prevailed by 15 over American University, number 13 Siena crunched number 4 Vanderbilt 83-62, number 12 Western Kentucky outlasted number 5 Drake 101-99, number 12 Villanova surprised number 5 Clemson, and number 13 University of San Diego wrecked the possibility that UConn would win both the men's and the women's tournaments by tripping up the Huskies 70-69. Fans of upsets watching the games in Tampa yesterday must have been especially delighted. The underdogs there went 4-0. However, it was Thursday night that provided almost everybody's favorite almost upset. In a game that was a great deal closer than anybody thought it would be, Belmont University of Nashville, a number 15 seed, came within a layup of upsetting Duke, a number 2 seed, as well as a veteran of these tournament things. Joining me now from Nashville is Rick Byrd, the coach of the Belmont University Bruins. Coach, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
Do you have any idea how many people watching that game were rooting for your guys?
You know, I don't know what the population of Durham is. I mean, the whole arena, except for the Duke guys, turned for Belmont for sure. And I'm, you know, Duke's like the Yankees, and I'm a Yankee fan, so, but they're so good, and we're so good for so long, it's just easy for a lot of folks to root against them. So I've heard that, and it's great for our university.
How did your players take the loss?
You know, there's 13 different guys in there, and they all take it in different ways. And you walk in, and there's guys crying their eyes out, and there's guys that are stoic, and there's guys that rebound quicker than others do. I don't think there's any question they all knew they'd been part of something special, and that their heart and courage and effort and confidence in each other had created that. And so it wasn't the hardest locker room I've ever been in. You couldn't help but be proud of them and say nothing but positive things.
All right, so now do you and your players root for Duke to win the tournament so you can say Belmont lost to the champs?
Well, you know what? 2 years ago, we lost to UCLA, and they made the championship game. Last year, we lost to Georgetown, and they made it to the Final Four. So, and it was hard not to as you went through. First of all, I admired both those programs after getting to know them, and certainly after Coach Krzyzewski responded as he did in such a gracious way about our team. He stopped and talked to every player on our team as he shook hands. Then it would be hard for a lot of reasons not to pull for Duke all the way through.
Well, it's very nice to hear that Coach Krzyzewski responded that way, but are you sure he wasn't saying to your players, son, how'd you like to think about transferring?
No, I better check with some of our guys. Hadn't thought about it that way. It's a thrill and really an honor to play against a great coach and a great program like that, and then to see all of their folks, their players the same way, firm handshake, look in the eye. Our players earned their respect. We're not Duke, but we're a strong academic school at Belmont, and our kids are great students, And it was a bunch of guys that are a lot alike out there competing against one another.
Well, even at a school where the academics are strong and the players are great students, you have to think hard about recruiting. That's a big part of your job.
Sure.
So will nearly beating Duke and really becoming the talk of the first day of the tournament make recruiting easier at Belmont?
If it doesn't, then I'm not doing my job very well. I don't think there's any question that it will. I think it's making the tournament 1 year was great for us. Making it 3 years in a row was better. But I think this legitimizes our program as a serious contender for very good players, and it hasn't been there before. So we're excited about what it may do for, you know, not only our basketball program but our university as a whole.
Now, do you get a vacation? I mean, because a game like that, let alone a whole season like the one you've just finished, it seems like maybe you ought to have a vacation.
Well, you know, if it weren't for these interviews like this one, I'd be on the golf course right now. But, you know, I wish we were preparing for West Virginia right now, but it'll be nice to not have to watch more tape and try to figure out how to beat the next team that we're playing. When you reach that point, it's time to sit back, and I hope we can enjoy it, but I hope we can improve and be a better team next year because of this.
Rick Byrd is the head coach of the men's basketball team at Belmont University. Coach, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, you're nice to ask. Thank you.
One of the teams that certainly expected to be in the tournament until quite recently is the University of Florida, the winner of each of the past two extravaganzas. But multiple graduations to the NBA, not to be confused with graduations from the university, left coach Billy Donovan with a team that crashed at the end of the regular season, as a result of which Florida is playing in the National Invitational Tournament instead of high-stepping at the Big Dance. Earlier this week, I spoke with Kevin Brockway of the Gainesville Sun, who told me how Coach Donovan attempted to motivate his team for their appearance in the secondary event.
They can't wear their Florida gear or Florida attire on campus. You know, they can still wear their sneakers, but that's about it. Billy decided to, have them work out in the auxiliary gym above the O'Connell Center, maybe to teach them a little bit of a lesson about humility or to show the tradition that was good enough for a lot of the early guys that built the program, Mike Miller, Udonis Haslam, and they certainly responded. It would have been easy to mail it in. You know, the O'Connell Center was about half full, but they came out, and it seemed like, you know, in the short term, they've responded to that challenge.
They certainly did. In their first round NIT game, Florida, playing at home, beat San Diego State 73-49, and then last night they thumped Creighton 82-54. But even if Florida runs the table and wins the tournament, the extravaganza to which the Gators failed to gain entrance will get the attention. Curiously, Kevin Brockway has managed to find an upside to that downer.
I guess the one thing is that usually this time of year you're doing a lot of traveling, so it's nice, especially now that they're at home, to catch your breath. And it'll be fun going to the local sports bar and watching the games on TV that you normally don't get a chance to watch when you're covering a team intensely during the NCAA tournament. So that aspect, maybe there's a little bit of a bonus.
Joining me now is Charlie Rosen, author of Barney Poulin's Game, a novel about the 1951 New York basketball scandals. Mr. Rosen, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
You have written extensively about the days when the National Invitational Tournament, a.k.a. the NIT, was basketball's biggest deal. Tell us a little bit about the attractions of that tournament 50 and more years ago.
Well, it was the first one. The first collegiate postseason tournament, which began in 1938. The NCAA started the tournament a year later in Evanston, Illinois, whereas the NIT always played their games in Madison Square Garden. So it was Evanston versus New York, the publicity capital of the world, Madison Square Garden, the mecca of basketball. Plus, I'm sure there were higher guarantees for colleges coming to New York and playing in Madison Square Garden.
Besides the obvious attraction of playing in Madison Square Garden, what are some of the other distinctions between the current NCAA tournament and the old NIT?
Well, the NIT began with six teams. I think 16 was the most they've had now. I can't even keep track of how many teams are in the NCAA. They have play-in games, and they keep extending it.
To what extent did the gambling scandals diminish the importance of the NIT?
It totally diminished it. For example, before the scandals in 1949, the NCAA championships were held in Seattle, and there were three top 10 teams in their tournament, and the NIT had five top 10 teams. After the scandals broke in 1951, the NCAA had eight top 10 teams, and the NIT only had three top 10 teams.
We heard a bit earlier in the program that Coach Billy Donovan went to some extraordinary measures to prepare his Florida team to play in the NIT, in part because his players no doubt assumed that they'd be defending the school's NCAA championship this week. But do lots of teams still come to the NIT excited about the experience?
I think it depends on the team. Young teams, maybe teams of freshmen, sophomores who are just coming into their own and laying a groundwork for perhaps what they can do as juniors and seniors. Teams that aren't really major top 10 powers, top 20 powers, are glad to get the exposure and get the money. But I think teams that did have ambitions to go to the NCAA are very, very disappointed by going to the NIT.
To what extent, you talk about exposure, to what extent does winning the NIT matter? What can a coach and a team hope to gain from prevailing there?
It means something. It is a national title, after all, and there is national publicity. It helps in recruiting. It certainly helps in a coach's resume. It does mean something. I would say qualifying for the Sweet 16 in the NCAA is probably more important than winning an NIT championship.
One of your recent books, Players and Pretenders, The Basketball Team That Couldn't Shoot Straight, concerns, among other things, your experience coaching the men's basketball team at Bard College about 18 years ago, where I'm guessing your tournament experience was minimal.
We would lose games by 40 points, 50 points. We even lost one game by 60 points. We had a power forward, a 5'6" power forward, pulled off the court during the game because he had to go to a rehearsal. He was in a Shakespearean play. I turned around, there were four guys on the court instead of five, and didn't find out till later that he was gone. But that was pure basketball to me. Everybody was playing for the love of the game. It was a whole different thing.
Charlie Rosen's latest book is No Blood, No Foul, a basketball novel set in post-war New York, and it'll be on the bookshelves on April 1st. Charlie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
For a look at Only a Game's redesigned website, please visit us at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Bello Yakub of Kebbi, Nigeria, has won some $34,500 in a contest that requires men to capture large fish with their hands. In the competition, which is sponsored by the Kebbi state government, over 20,000 participants lined up a kilometer away from the Faden Mata River. At the sound of the starter's gun, the men ran into the river in pursuit of fish called Giwan Rua, which means elephant of the ocean. The fish Bello Yakub caught weighed 145 pounds. Said the happy winner, "I just hope I can use the prize money for something good." I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, quarks, leptons, errant passes, bricked jump shots, and record losing streaks as documented on a new film about Caltech basketball. But first, in the early 1990s, the Toronto Blue Jays won back-to-back World Series, drew a record 4 million fans a year to their new domed stadium, and boasted baseball's largest payroll. But after only 6 winning seasons in the last 14, the Jays play to half-filled houses and have taken up perennial residence behind the Yankees and the Red Sox in the American League East. From Dunedin, Florida, Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports on the Blue Jays' 2008 prospects.
Longtime Blue Jays radio announcer Jerry Howarth has seen the disparity between his team and its East Coast rivals grow. He notes that last year the Jays' payroll fell short of $80 million, compared to $195 million for the Yankees and almost $145 million for the Red Sox.
Well, it's very difficult because of the Yankees and the Red Sox depth of resources. And the Blue Jays in that division have to play each of them 18 times. That's very difficult no matter what your payroll is. And I thought last year with 12 surgeries, you began to see what happens when you don't have those deep resources to help fill that void.
Those surgeries affected everyone from closer B.J. Ryan to first baseman Lyle Overbay and outfielder Reed Johnson. Still, insists veteran-designated hitter Frank Thomas, the Blue Jays managed to hold their own.
We had 12 star players go down at different times last year, and we still were able to win 83 games, and most of the time we had a patchwork lineup. We used a lot of guys from AAA last year, but we found a way to win a lot of ball games. So I think it helped build character for this team.
And Thomas predicts that a healthy Blue Jays squad can win a lot more.
Our players stack up with any team in the AL. Man-to-man, pitching staff. Look at our lineup, look at everybody else's lineup.
Besides Thomas, who chipped in 27 home runs and 95 RBIs in his first season with the Blue Jays, Toronto is counting on power-hitting third baseman Scott Rolen, acquired in an offseason trade with the St. Louis Cardinals. The pitching staff includes former Cy Young winner Roy Halladay, who went 16-7 last year, A.J. Burnett, who finished with a 12-10 record, and a developing core of young starters. Closer Ryan, who saved 38 games in 2006 before missing most of 2007, is back in the bullpen. Still, center fielder Vernon Wells, who signed a 7-year, $126 million contract extension and then put up the worst offensive numbers in his 6 years as a starter, says that any preseason talk of passing the Yankees or Red Sox is premature.
Obviously, on paper, we have a pretty good team, and I think that we've been doing a great job of building this team for the last few years, and obviously, we're still third until we prove otherwise. We can match up. I mean, you can talk about it all you want to, but until you go out and prove that you can do what those two teams have done over the last 10, 11 years, then talk is nothing.
That hasn't stopped some baseball pundits from picking the Blue Jays to win the AL East this year.
Touchdown number 10, Derek Jeter.
On an early March afternoon in Dunedin, Toronto had the chance to test itself against the visiting Yankees. The teams barely got past the first inning before a long rain delay sent their starting lineups packing. But Yankee star Derek Jeter says he doesn't need any more evidence of the Blue Jays' potential.
We don't overlook them. Not at all. Toronto's always played us tough, especially this year. They got a great team. As long as they're healthy, they're as good as it comes.
Yankee center fielder Johnny Damon agrees.
They've got the best top-to-bottom pitching in the league. They had it last year. They have it again. We know what Burnett and Halladay can do, but their pitching is solid. Their bullpen's good. And with B.J. Ryan coming back to close out games, I mean, that's going to be tougher. They have a chance to win our division.
While the Blue Jays can no longer be discounted in the AL East, neither can the Canadian currency that's long kept them at a competitive disadvantage. It used to take $1.50 Canadian dollars to equal $1 in the United States, which made it harder for the Blue Jays to pursue high-priced free agents. With the occasional plunge of the U.S. dollar to below $1 Canadian, Toronto's budget should be able to go further in their next round of signings. For now, the main beneficiaries are the Canadian tourists flocking to Dunedin. Toronto native Pamela Furman and her son-in-law Jeff Swayze have been coming down for the last 5 springs and have noticed the difference this year.
It's really nice when you go to get your traveler's checks, you know, and you say, I want $500 U.S. and you get change out of $500 Canadian. You know, it's really good.
We normally come down for 2 to 3 weeks. This year we've rented a house for the entire month of March. Right off the bat, we're saving 20%.
And how about players like Frank Thomas?
Would you like it if they now paid you in Canadian dollars?
No, that's not the way we sign the things.
While Toronto's general manager, J.P. Ricciardi, isn't yet using the exchange rate to the Blue Jays' advantage, he does see a distinct edge in being spared the blistering media and fan scrutiny that the Yankees and Red Sox endure daily.
We'd rather both those clubs have to deal with all the stuff that, you know, we really don't want to deal with. So, for us, we think it's a definite benefit. We have internal goals and you know, objectives that we want to accomplish, but those are more self-driven, not media-driven. You know, we have no problem being the team that flies under the radar.
That may be hard to do when the Blue Jays open the 2008 season on March 31st at Yankee Stadium. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Dunedin, Florida.
Some of the teams that have made the NCAA tournaments could be considered underdogs. None of them has ever been as far under or as utterly doggish as the men's basketball team at the California Institute of Technology. When they attracted the attention of documentary filmmaker Rick Greenwald in 2006, Caltech was the not-so-proud owner of a 21-year losing streak, a streak in which they had not beaten a conference opponent in 240 games. The resulting film is called Quantum Hoops, the Caltech Basketball Story. Rick Greenwald joins me now from NPR West. Rick, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to introduce our listeners to the situation you encountered at Caltech by playing a scene from your film. We'll hear first from Roy Dow, the current coach, and then from your narrator, David Duchovny.
The number of valedictorians on the team this past year was 8. The number of players that played high school varsity basketball is 6. 6 is a big leap for us from 2 years ago when we only had 2 players.
What these players lack on the court, they make up for in the classroom. They represent a student body that is widely considered to be among the brightest in the world. Nearly every player had a perfect math score on their SATs, and with an uncompromising admissions policy, they are the most academically elite team in all of college basketball.
That situation that you're exploring, high school valedictorians outnumbering high school basketball players, is a little surreal and quite a contrast to Duchovny's dry, matter-of-fact delivery. Is that why you wanted him to narrate the film?
Oh, for sure. The initial instinct was to get a so-called geek icon, and he was, you know, the X-Files star. But the dry humor part, that, you know, the X-Files show itself, every other episode was either something with a little comedy spin or something serious, and the film is definitely a mix of that.
I'm just curious about whether there was ever a point in reading the narration where he looked up and said, "Can this really be true?"
Well, he had seen the film a couple times beforehand, but yeah, and the coach was actually at the record, so I went there and saw it for myself, and it's for real. They did lose, and they do lose badly continually, and they did it for 21 years, and it's surreal, to say the least.
It's very nice to be the most academically elite team in college basketball, I'm sure, but obviously what attracted you to the Caltech Beavers was their status as an exceptionally feudal team. When you approached them, how did the coach and the players feel about having their futility documented?
They were a little bit nervous. Roy, the coach, he's always open to somebody publicizing the team just for exposure, because he's trying to get the word out that they do have a team, for one, and that he's looking for players. And the players themselves, there was an article that had come out prior, and they weren't exactly happy about it. That made them kind of look a little silly, of course. And they were nervous. Here's a guy now coming with a camera. It's one thing to be in print, but now you get to show us, you know, visually. I didn't realize there was incredible depth of history and accomplishments there, and that some of their athletes have gone on to do great things. That part I did not expect. My intention wasn't to mock them or make fun of them. The comedy sort of inherent.
Well, your determination not to ridicule them notwithstanding, the film does open with one of the great sequences of all time in terms of basketball ineptitude. They must have, I mean, the first few minutes, they must have thought, my God, what have we let ourselves in for here?
Yep. I was scared to death our first screening, and a former player was there. He came up and he said, "I almost got up and walked out. I couldn't believe what this was going to be." He's like, "I'm so glad I stayed, because, you know, it pays off in the end." And that was really for the person who doesn't really know the story. That's what that was all about, to show where they're going. You really need to see where they've been, which is all the bad basketball.
Well, this sequence that we're talking about, of course, is players falling down, you know, balls bouncing around the gym like pool balls on a pool table with no particular recipient anywhere in sight, this sort of thing. And I have tossed out some numbers as well, but give us a sense of just how bad this basketball team has been.
Well, 2 years prior to when I was following them, they were losing by an average of 60 points a game, on average. Some of the games they lost by 70, 80, 90 points. There's a score, 137 to 15 or 20. And that, I mean, that's a real score. And that's, what do you do when you're the 5 worst players on the team? The coach has no worse players to put in to try and alleviate
you know, the big, huge gap. And
you go to just, four or three.
Right? Well, I don't think the league would allow them. And that's part of the tricky thing about it. At certain points during the streak, they had talked about dropping Caltech from the conference. It's the SCIAC conference in Southern California. They once played UCLA and USC, and those schools obviously went on to bigger and better things and went to the Pac-10. But, you know, it's hard to kick Caltech out of a conference they co-founded. And that was the past. I started picking up with the team as they narrowed the gaps down to an average of about 20 points a game, which is something incredible.
Well, UCLA and USC went on to bigger and better things as long as we're talking about basketball. But in terms right. of patents and Nobel Prizes and things like that, they couldn't mm-hmm. touch Caltech. And maybe you knew when you began this project that you would be interviewing a number of distinguished scientists and mathematicians. Did you anticipate how excited they would be about basketball?
Had no idea. Roy had clued me in that he had a couple Nobel Prize-winning physicists and chemists who kind of supported the program. And one of them is in the film. His name's Bob Grubbs. He actually co-won his Nobel Prize with an MIT professor as well. And he was very supportive. He's supportive of the program. And he wished, you know, part of the story is the coach can't get anybody to pass admissions. They refuse to let anybody in, period, who doesn't qualify academically. And he's one of the guys who kind of shrugs his shoulder and says, I really wish we have guys who have maybe not a perfect SAT score, but close to it, and they weren't the valedictorian. They were the next in line, and they were a varsity basketball player, not a star even, just a varsity basketball player, and they won't let him in. And the joke is that he had basketball on his application, and that was a knock because maybe he's not going to spend enough time on the computer. He's going to be spending too much time on the court. You know, I mean, they've actually had that comment.
In one of your film's more moving moments, we hear about Caltech breaking its last long losing streak. The year was 1979, and the Beavers had just won a game against a conference opponent for the first time in 99 games. The memories are provided by two members of that team and the coach of the losing team. NBA fans may recognize his voice, future Hall of Fame coach Greg Popovich. Let's listen to that.
I just remember the buzzer going off. It was just such a shock. We lost the game, and I provided a great deal of enjoyment for about 15 or 20 people. I can remember that for sure. We were all jumping around. I was hugging Joe Zazadinsky, and I remember we were just jumping around like little kids.
You know, I wish we could say we were, you know, good winners, you know, and polite to the other team and everything. Perhaps if we had won a second game, we would have handled it better and we would have been calm and said, you know, nice game. You guys tried hard. We were just having a party.
Three people I knew were in the stands that game, but it didn't matter. We won a game, a real game.
I guess the Caltech guys who played in that game could be forgiven for celebrating on the court. I wonder if any of them could have anticipated how rare those celebrations would be.
They knew. The only ones who don't know are the freshman members of the team. Every freshman comes in saying, well, before I'm done, I'm going to win not one, I'm going to win two or three, and you know, things like that. And we're talking just games, not being over 500 right. or a championship. Right. We're just talking a game. And then by the time they get to be a senior and they realize they haven't won one yet, the pressure is really on, and that's where the big celebration comes from. A regular season game, that's one of the things that makes this story so unique. There's no school in the country that will have a championship celebration after a single regular season win that means really nothing to anybody else, not to their opponent or anybody.
I'm speaking with Rick Greenwald, director of Quantum Hoops. You're listening to Only a Game. As you followed Caltech through the 2006 season, to what extent did you become a fan of the team?
You know, I became a fan, I think, by the end of day one, to be honest, when I realized something else was going on here. I went in with the same expectations everybody else did, which is this is a team, it's kind of a joke, it's just comedy. They must not care. And it didn't take a couple hours to see how they practice and how hard Roy pushes them. How can you keep going game after game after game after game and practice after practice knowing you virtually have no chance? And over, you know, the course of a couple of months, things just kept popping up. The Popovich story. I mean, Caltech's won two games in the last 35 years, and one of them was against a future NBA coach, Hall of Fame coach,
Hall of Fame
championship coach.
coach.
You know, I mean, that's that. My eyes were popping out of my head. Like, this is ridiculous. And then he agreed to be interviewed.
Toward the end of the 2006 season, there is considerable tension surrounding the Caltech team. They're losing games by 9 or 10 points rather than by 50 or 60. And beyond that, there's some talk of eliminating sports altogether at Caltech. Let's listen to what some of the players had to say as that season was running out.
We're capable of winning, and it's just a matter of breaking through this invisible wall, because I think that we are good enough to beat other teams.
I feel like the real defining moment will be when we can get a win, and each and every one of us can do our part to get that.
We're getting closer to winning, and so that's tough, knowing that we can win now. Even if we don't win, I know we gave our best.
I think it'd just be this big accomplishment that I would remember for the rest of my life.
Other people wouldn't be able to jeer at us so much anymore if we could finally get that win.
Now, I don't want to discuss the result of the final home game of the 2006 season. People could look it up on the internet, I suppose, but I'm sure you're hoping they don't.
Yeah, I hope. Don't look it up. You know, it's a great surprise, and it's real. That's the best part. It's as good as any ending to a sports film you've seen. It's as intense. Some guy said it's as intense as any Super Bowl or World Series game I've ever seen. And when I was there filming it, I was thinking the same thing.
Rick Greenwald is the director of Quantum Hoops, the Caltech basketball story. The film will be showing next week in Boston and in Seattle and in limited theaters in Texas in April. For a more thorough listing, visit our newly redesigned website at onlyagame.org. Rick, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The charms of playing golf in a foreign land are myriad. Exotic scenery, challenging new hazards, the company of strangers. But a South Korean tour group is now trying to make it possible for its clients to play where history was made, at least according to North Korea's historians. The five-day trip would include rounds at the golf course outside Pyongyang. The official media of North Korea described the holes on the course as, quote, diverse and peculiar in style. They were, however, not peculiar enough to throw North Korea's dear leader, Kim Jong-il, a novice golfer, off his game. On his only visit to the course, Kim allegedly made 11 holes in one, while carding a score 20 strokes lower than any professional golfer has ever made anywhere. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Welsh rugby for the Welsh. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The women's NCAA basketball tournament begins today. Which is the more likely first-round upset, Cornell over Connecticut or Oral Roberts over Tennessee?
Well, first of all, good for Cornell, having the men's and women's team in the tournament this year. And I think that they'll look back on this year very fondly, but they're not going to look back on the last game very fondly in either case.
Turning to the men's tournament, have you a favorite first-round upset on the men's side? It's a pretty short list.
Well, this is sadly becoming typical. There was one really bad day, and my favorite game was the Davidson, coached by Bobby McKillop, who's a friend of mine, behind a terrific performance by Stephon Curry, son of Del Curry, who played in the NBA, beating Gonzaga. And the interesting phenomenon is, of course, Gonzaga has now been Gonzaga. Davidson is what Gonzaga used to be.
That's
Gonzaga
right.
is now a target school.
Meanwhile, never mind that the tournament is upon us, one New Jersey state senator has called for an investigation of Tennessee's victory over Rutgers more than a month ago. What redress is Senator Singer seeking?
I don't know if I could say that, but the key phrase in this whole thing is non-binding legislation. You know what non-binding legislation is? You hang it on your wall, basically. It's like getting a verbal commitment from a player. As my friend the late Abe Lemons once said, a verbal commitment is not worth the paper it's printed on. And a non-binding piece of legislation is worth even less.
The debate over whether there's room for another spring college hoops tourney is bubbling. You're giggling, but it's bubbling, I assure you, if not exactly raging. And I'm not talking about the NIT. Have you been following the first annual College Basketball Invitational?
No, I haven't, but they have one intriguing element in this tournament. That is that their championship is a series. It's a best out of three. It's not a one-game thing. So, at the very least, that will put them in another place than the NIT Final Four and the regular men's Final Four.
Moving along to pro basketball, the Rockets made their case for 22 games that they were perhaps the team to beat in 2008, but the Rockets misfired on Tuesday against the Boston Celtics, whose Southwest trip left Houston, San Antonio, and Dallas thoroughly toasted. I guess you can mess with Texas.
The very interesting thing about the Celtics is every time they've put a benchmark in front of them, they've met it and cleared it by there's daylight between them and the bar, basically. The West Coast trip was going to be the big test for them. They handled that easily. The Texas trip was going to be a test for them. They handled that with supreme ease. I mean, winning a tough game in San Antonio and then the next night going out and handling Houston very, very easily. This is right now the best team in the NBA.
Kevin Garnett can't have been too pleased to read this week that his former employer thinks he tanked the end of the 06-07 season. What's Timberwolves owner Glenn Taylor's gripe?
He's finding it very difficult to deal with the fact that he's an idiot and his general manager is an idiot, and Kevin Garnett was there for 12 years and they couldn't put a team around him to win anything. This was absolutely uncalled for. It's impossible to imagine Kevin Garnett, quote-unquote, tanking. This is a team, by the way, that in the Joe Smith cage wrecked their future by trying to be a little bit smarter than the salary cap is. So I have no sympathy at any time for the Minnesota Timberwolves.
We've got two remarkable NBA game scores to consider this week, Charlie. In one of those games, the Miami Heat scored just 54 points, and in the other, the Denver Nuggets scored 168 points. It's a shame, isn't it, that those two teams weren't playing each other?
Well, that would have been ugly. The Heat, you talk about giving up on the year. The Heat has just folded. Pat Riley's coming to the games. They're not coming to the games. Dwayne Wade's taking the year off. That is just very sad. A 10-point second quarter just can't happen. And the Nuggets score on people, and they can score 150 and lose, and they can score 160 and win. They are, at the very least, fun to watch.
Pro-Tibet protests in Nepal have, among other things, raised the possibility of boycotts at the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing. What do you make of France's foreign minister initially taking a strong stand and then deciding that some economic decisions must be made, quote, at the expense of human rights?
No kidding, really? Did he wake up yesterday morning and realize that? Actually, what he was originally advocating, which is a boycott of the opening ceremonies, mm-hmm. is not a terrible idea. I mean, if you don't want to boycott the entire Olympics because, for whatever reason, you don't think it's fair to the athletes and because history says that these things don't work anyway, staying out of the parade by which China celebrates itself impresses me as being a fairly reasoned and rational and humane response.
The Boston Red Sox will, in fact, open the baseball season in Japan, but before they left the country on Wednesday, the Sox initially said they wouldn't go. Travel anxiety?
No, they were actually sticking up for their coaches and trainers and support staff, who they allege, through some sort of miscommunication, had been promised $40,000 and then told they weren't going to get it. I thought it was a terrific stand on the merits for the Red Sox. I think it's terrific for the esprit de corps of the ball club. And I think if anybody thought this Red Sox team was not unified, they were wrong. And this demonstrated it. In addition, this is a remarkably generous bunch of baseball players because, as I recall, in 2004, the Red Sox gave out more full playoff shares than any team in the history of baseball. Yeah. So this is what they do.
Major League Baseball Players Association Chief Donald Fehr announced this week that there will be an investigation of why Barry Bonds has not been offered a job. Charlie, do you think that this will be a short investigation?
No, I think they're going to look at it quite seriously because I think they think there's a blackball against Barry Bonds. I also think they're right, by the way. The interesting thing will come midway through the season when somebody decides they needed a bat in the lineup, probably somebody in the American League who can put him at a DH. Then we'll see whether the collusion is real or not.
Still, it's nice to hear the C word come up again regarding Major League Baseball, isn't it? Collusion, one of your favorites,
yes.
I know. Time for some Cubs humor. A bunch of Chicago players took up their bats and smashed the car belonging to the team's strength coach. Smashed it to scrap metal, in fact. There's nothing like a practical joke to spice up spring training, say I, but This was more than a practical joke, right?
Yeah, they beat up his old Nissan Sentra and gave him a new Nissan SUV and apparently moved him to tears. But it's interesting because I can probably argue that this will be the hardest thing the Cubs hit all year. But a bump, seriously.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe and joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
My mention of ski champion Bodie Miller's World Cup title last week did not thrill Charlie Pierce, who opined that he'd heard enough about Mr. Miller and did not wish to hear any more. Rick Walter, who hears Only a Game on New Hampshire Public Radio, called the listener line to say he'd heard about enough from Charlie.
Bodie Miller does things his own way, that's true. But, you know, he won the overall this year by going on his own. And I guess for a writer like Charlie to denigrate somebody who takes even more risk, and you can't see achievement in that. I mean, it's like the loser is what comes to mind when I think of a writer like Charlie that can't appreciate that kind of achievement.
Mr. Walter had lots of company. Jim Snyder, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio, thinks we missed an opportunity to celebrate the dedication and focus that have enabled Miller to climb to the top of his sport. Pamela Swing, another Vermont listener, felt we did a disservice to, quote, a grueling, beautiful, and challenging sport, and she, quote, no longer finds Charlie's flippancy funny. Another New Hampshire listener who signed his email Sky King urged Charlie to, quote, fake a little patriotism on this one. On the other hand, Christina Anderson, a WBUR listener, wrote that she liked it when Charlie, quote, thoughtfully swore like a sailor last week and added that she finds him vastly amusing. Numbers of people, among them Donald Carroll, who hears Only a Game on WYPR in Baltimore, wrote or called to point out that I had mistakenly placed Mount St. Mary's College in Connecticut, the home of the team they beat at the end of the regular season, instead of in Maryland, where the college actually is. Mount St. Mary's showed no ill effects, though. They beat Coppin State in the NCAA tournament's so-called play-in game on Tuesday night. Unhappily, that win earned the feisty Mountaineers the opportunity to play number one seed University of North Carolina. Oops. Jim Nickel, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, was disappointed that my conversation with Michelle Smith did not include mention of the Marist College women's basketball team. Sorry, Mr. Nickel. They had a great season, but it's a big tournament. Jennifer Eubank, who hears Only a Game on KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, wrote to say, wow, loved the Arctic Winter Games update. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, or write us a letter at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. The Six Nations Rugby Tournament is that game's annual European Championship. This year, the final day of matches included a grudge match between England and Ireland and an unlikely Wales squad going for the gold against powerhouse France. Scott Baronato reports from Boston, where fans gathered at a pub to watch.
Every Saturday during Six Nations Rugby, yeah, religiously. And we're usually the first here, so...
Tom O'Shea and his wife Susan arrive at 8 a.m. at McGann's Pub in Boston. Dressed in matching Kelly Green rugby shirts, they sip coffee and eat the full Irish. A breakfast of eggs, baked beans, sausage, ham, hash browns, toast, and blood pudding. O'Shea is from Dublin, but he's lived in the United States for 18 years. His wife is from Chicago, where she first learned of her husband's obsession with rugby.
It was a World Cup game, so that was the first game I'd ever seen. We saw it at about 4 o'clock in the morning, because I think they were playing in Australia at the time. Watched it live. We just started dating, and I just kept looking at him going, are you mad? Going to a bar at 4 o'clock in the morning to watch a sporting event.
Susan married Tom anyway, and now she even likes rugby. Both O'Shea's will be rooting for Ireland against England this morning on the final day of the Six Nations Rugby Tournament. That matchup is European rugby's version of Carolina Duke, Yankees Red Sox, in Ohio State, Michigan. But today, it's the undercard. In an unlikely championship game, Wales will face France. Wales have already won the coveted Triple Crown by beating England, Ireland, and Scotland. If Wales win today, they will complete the Grand Slam, a perfect 5-0 tournament record, and a year of bragging rights for the little country that loves rugby the way Texas loves football. They love the game so much, the Welsh in America will hunt far and wide for a pub showing the matches.
The first year I was here, went to Paddy Burke's, and they had trouble with the reception, got kicked out.
Dean Murphy is originally from Gosynan, a factory town outside Swansea in Wales. He's met at local pubs with friends to watch the rugby for over a decade.
Some American guy took two of us over to the Power Stars in Cambridge, and as I met Dick, Irig, Rod, and basically we've been meeting up every year for the Six Nations ever since, 10, 12 years.
McGann's is already filling up with many Irish and a few English supporters as the match for last place between Italy and Scotland finishes up. It's 10:30 and some are still ordering coffee and tea, but others have started calling for pints. Dean finds a few of his longtime rugby friends, including Irish native Jeff Foley. Though Dean and Jeff root for different teams, they can easily agree on which team to root against.
Everybody wants England to lose,
yeah. There's nothing against the English. Just want them to lose.
By the time the English and Irish national anthems start, about 200 fans have filled the pub to capacity. Some of them sit on the floor in front of the massive projection TV, eating their Irish breakfasts with their plates in their laps. The match starts out well for the Irish, who control the play early in an intense and physical match.
Some big hits going in already. Oh, nice. Atmosphere's got up a bit in there.
Ireland sees a 10-0 lead, but in the second half, Ireland squanders several chances while England score 33 unanswered points. Final, 33-10 England. Susan and Tom O'Shea silently endure taunts from English friends. By the time Ireland's too far behind to catch up, Dean Murphy turns his thoughts to what rugby means to the Welsh.
I was brought up with it. My mother's watching it, my grandmother's watching it. It's just a Welsh tradition. It's like, and then when I was at school, the choice was cross-country run or play rugby. So, and Wales lose, it's the whole country's depressed. So when they win, the whole country's joyed. It's amazing.
But the Welsh seldom enjoy that kind of amazement. Wales' reputation is flagged since it last dominated rugby more than a quarter century ago. Several Welsh fans stand and sing their national anthem. They have come out in force. Murphy's crew is here, including a woman named Rhian, who says she is terrified for her team, and Irig, who is talking to a Welsh friend who drove up from Cape Cod at 6:30 this morning. Tony Roberts and his German wife drove in from their home in western Massachusetts the previous night. Will Evans and his American wife, Angela, wear bright red Welsh rugby tops with the word Brains, Wales' most famous beer, printed across the front. Stephen Price, 63, a physician from Essex, Massachusetts, sits on the floor in front of the projection TV. His 89-year-old mother back in Wales suffered a stroke just a month ago.
But for these matches in Wales in the nursing home, she puts on a hat, a scarf, and honestly, she's so partisan, but she comes alive, you know.
Price is here with his 10-year-old grandson, Aidan.
Knows the Welsh chant.
Aggie, aggie, aggie. Oi, oi, oi. Come on.
Aggie, aggie, aggie.
Oi, oi, oi.
Aggie. Oi.
Aggie.
Oi.
Aggie, aggie, aggie.
Oi, oi, oi.
That's the secret of the Welsh wins when we start shouting and singing.
A French fan rallies for his team as the first half of the championship match gets underway. Welsh fans are tense and quiet, even though their squad enjoy a 9-6 lead at halftime. But early in the second half, Welsh player Shane Williams gives chase to a loose ball. Williams sprints after the ball and touches it down for a spectacular try, 5 points, and Wales never look back, eventually posting a 29-12 victory over favored France. Little Wales is king of European rugby. Welsh supporters hug and cry. Brian McConkie of Cardiff rubs his glassy red eyes. McConkie is explaining that he's here with his wife, Wendy, to celebrate her 60th birthday when he's interrupted by an Irish supporter, one of many congratulating their Celtic cousins.
Well done, congratulations. Fair play, fair play.
Thank you very much.
Great to see you. Great to see Wales.
This is what you get in rugby. It's wonderful.
That's just wonderful.
Across the room, Stephen Price hugs his son Hugh and wraps his arms around his grandson Aiden.
Feels wonderful.
Wales did it, boy. Wales. Wales.
Cymru am byth. Translation, Wales forever. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Baronato in Boston.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about quantum hoops, download our weekly podcast, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Quantum Hoops director Rick Greenwald. He quotes an anonymous Caltech hoopster.
I'm the worst player on the worst team in the country. It kind of makes me wonder sometimes what I'm doing.
Well, aside from studying the hyperfine structure of hydrogenic atoms, Fermi degeneracy, and string theory, probably not all that much. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. What did I just say? I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.